Catch up later. Okay. Good evening, one and all. We turn to another pivotal parsha. And I'm going to do things a little differently. This week, it's become somewhat a habit now over the past few weeks that we spend the lion's share of our time doing an overview and then put a pasuk under pressure for about a minute and a half and then run out of time. So I'll give a very, very brief overview, and then we'll turn to the opening episode of the parasha, which really is the major event, and you may be surprised to know the Malbim has a lot to say about it. And in fact, one of the first times I was introduced to the Malbim by somebody who was, for want of a better word, obsessed with the Malbim, said, "Oh, you should just see the Malbim at the beginning of Shlach. You just see that and you'll fall in love and you won't need anything else." So I wasn't entirely sure what he meant by that. I'm still not entirely sure what he meant by that, but we'll give it a spin and we'll see how it goes. So this week's parsha, Shlach Lecha, as the name suggests, begins with what sounds on the surface like an instruction, right? Shlach Lecha sounds like, you shall send. When else do we have a compound instruction that sounds pretty similar to Shlach Lecha? It's also the name of a parsha.
Lech Lecha.
Lech Lecha. Now, Lech Lecha, did that go bad or did that go well?
Well.
Was that a good journey, a bad journey? Yeah, I think you said well.
Good.
Indeed. It was the start of Jewish history. It was Avram making a nation and a name for himself. And now we have an echo of that. Shlach Lecha, and as we know, we don't know quite yet when we're starting out, but this isn't going to end well at all. And it sounds like it was kind of weighted with possibility at the start, and it was ruined along the way, and we'll turn to how that ruin came to be shortly. But how does Rashi read Lech Lecha in its original instantiation with Avram? When Avram is sent, Lech Lecha, God could have just said Lech. He could have just said Shlach. What is Lecha doing? So what does Lech Lecha do? Right, Rashi, citing the sages, says Lech Lecha, when Avram is told to go, Lecha literally can be translated as for you. This is going to feel uncertain. It's going to feel unnatural. It's going to feel that it grains against every instinct in your body to walk away from everything you've ever known, Avram. But Lecha, this is for you. This is in your interest. So we have Shlach Lecha now, and we have almost the opposite here. The way that Rashi reads Shlach Lecha, how does Rashi read Lecha here?
For your sake.
Right, so it's for your sake in a very different way. It's not for your benefit, but if you must, right? Shlach Lecha, look, if you want to, you can do it, but don't put my name anywhere near this. So you have a divergence right in the very start in that second word of the parasha. Either way, Shlach Lecha, the spies are sent. We give a list of the names of the spies who are sent. How do we say spies in Hebrew? Meraglim. Does the word Meraglim come up in the parsha?
No.
No, it doesn't come up in this parsha. So we're going to have to figure out why they're called Meraglim. We'll get to that as well. Yehoshua's name is changed from Hosea to Yehoshua. Why does Moshe change Yehoshua's name or Hosea's name?
Hashem's guidance with him.
To protect him. Protect him from what?
Other spies.
Interesting. So embedded in that assumption, which is broadly shared, are a couple of problems, right? What problems, if you're playing devil's advocate and you're listening to Moshe, Moshe says Yehoshua, or he says Hosea, I'm changing your name. You're now Yehoshua. God will insulate you, protect you from the influences. You'll be okay. And you're over-listening. You're standing in the background. What might you say? If you're Yehoshua, you might turn to Moshe and say, hold on, Moshe, I've got a couple of questions. What might you ask?
If you're that worried, why are you sending us?
Okay, number one, this doesn't sound like you're overly optimistic about this mission. You start off with a prayer to protect me from influence. Why don't you just tell us to stay here, number one? Number two, if they do have to go, what's question two?
Why are you worried about the other Moroccan doing something bad?
Okay, so I kind of parcel that together. You got home pretty quickly, Jerry. I don't know how you did that. But good to hear your voice.
Not that far.
So question one kind of parceled together is, why are you worried about these Meraglim? If you are worried, why are you sending us? But then question two, hold on, Moshe, if you're worried and you're the leader of all the people, what do most presidents say when they get to the podium? Say, I'm not just the president of the people who voted for me, I'm the president of everybody. My job is to care for all of you. So Moshe, I know I'm your guy. I know I'm the guy who served on you and waited on you for decades. Couple of years. It will be decades. But aren't you the leader of all of us? Why are you changing my name to protect me? Why don't you pray for all the spies and protect us all? It's a very odd moment where Moshe seems to express or exhibit favoritism, nepotism. He's saying, Yeshua, I need you to be okay. The rest of them can go by the wayside. How do we explain that distinction? If you were Moshe's defense attorney, what would you say? Oh, no, let me tell you why Moshe did this.
Perhaps he thought that Yehoshua has been under his influence all the time and hasn't been exposed to these other elements and still want to protect him from that point of view.
Too naive.
Okay, that's interesting. Meaning the others are too far lost already?
No, I think maybe he was more of on a spiritual basis and has not had much to do with mundane things like this. I don't know.
Okay, I think you're inching towards where the Torah Tumimah ends up, which is, I mean, he's more extreme. But what it sounds like you're suggesting is, actually, he was most worried about Yehoshua.
He's been in a protected environment. He wasn't amongst the people as much. He was more naive.
So he's davening for Yehoshua because the others, he thinks, is already, they're down to earth, they're engaged with the people, they understand challenges, they've had ups and downs, they haven't been shielded by my aura, and they can cope with this mission, but Yehoshua's too innocent, so I need to give him an extra level of protection. Is that what it sounds like?
Or he knows Yehoshua's going to follow him as the leader, and he needed extra protection.
Yehoshua needs extra protection because who's going to follow who?
Yehoshua is going to follow Moshe as the leader of Bnei Yisrael.
Oh, meaning he foresaw this whole thing unfolding and he thought the Yehoshua is going to need help to stick to his guns.
Yes.
Okay, that's all very interesting. The Torah Tumimah suggests, as I've insinuated, that actually Moshe didn't think this was going to go terribly wrong. Of course he didn't. He wouldn't have let them go. Moshe thought this was a reasonable mission. He sent them to go, but he had one worry, that somebody in the group was going to come back and gossip about the land. And who was he worried about gossiping? Yehoshua. Why? What on earth, in his experience, would make him think that Yehoshua was going to be the bad, what was it, the bad egg? That's not what you're saying.
Bad seed.
Bad seed. Why did it? Well, that's exactly why, actually. The Torah Tumimah says, because Yehoshua was a descendant of the tribe of Yosef. Exactly. And Yosef told gossip about his brothers when he was a young kid. So deep in his genetic makeup, the impression that Torah Tumimah suggests that Moshe had was that Yehoshua was liable to slide into gossip, so he needed protection. Everybody else was okay. And of course, what arises out of that is the utter misdirection that was on the part of Moshe. To think his genetic character is going to determine his fate, he needs protection. And in the end, of course, as a great Englishman once said, Albus Dumbledore, we are the choices that we make. Oh, well, that's not exactly the words, but I didn't have time to look it up, and I don't know. Forgive me. But he basically says, we are not who we were born, but what the choices that we make. And that's essentially the error, it seems, at least in this moment here when Yeshua's name is changed. Moshe, in the eyes of Torah Tumimah, says, Yeshua's going to gossip because Yehoshua has got this genetic proclivity to gossip, and everybody else will be okay. And in the end, Yehoshua, of course, needed no assistance. He was a spiritually inclined figure who'd made decisions about moral choices, and the others were, just because they were insulated by their genetics, in no way stopped them from sinning. So that's really Rishon. Yeshua's name is changed. We have the list of all the spies. Off they go. Then we get on to Sheni. In Sheni of the Parsha, they go to scout the land. They're there for 40 days. They got the Hebron. They sit down by the valley of the cluster, Nachal Eshkol. They get a bunch of grapes. They found Kedem wineries to have the little signal. Is it Kedem that has the grape picture?
Carmel.
Oh, I've done false advertising. What does Kedem have? It just says Kedem in big letters.
Kedem is American.
Oh, Kedem's American?
Yeah. Kedem's in oil
wine. Oh, all right. They found that some winery with a picture of big grapes on it. They brought the grapes back with them. They come report to the people. Everybody's in tears. They say, yes, it's flowing with milk and honey, but it was horrible. There are big people there, and we're all scared. We're all going to die. No one should panic, but we're all going to die. Everybody cries. Big problems. The camp nearly falls apart. Then we get into Shlishi, Yehoshua, and Kalev step up and say, hold on a minute. No, that's not what we saw. We need to correct the record here. Yehoshua and Kalev are seen as heroes by Kadosh Baruch and Moshe. Hashem threatens to wipe out the people. Moshe appeals for clemency on the part of the people again. He's done this before and he does it again. Prayed for their clemency, invokes the formula that he was given back in Shemot. Hashem, Hashem, Kel Racham V'Chanon, please have mercy on the people. Hashem offers to make a new people from Moshe's seed. He says, no, save the people. The people are saved, but it's not just the slate is wiped clean. They will now have to compensate for this sin. 40 years wandering in the desert, 1 year for each day. And then we have a very counterintuitive moment where B'nai Israel seem immediately to do tshuva. They said, we can't go, we're all going to die. It's not, we should go back to Egypt, forget it. And then Hashem says, you didn't have enough faith, forget it. And they say, okay, the next morning we've done reflection, we've done thinking, we're ready. Now we're going to, let's just go. No more questions asked. And God says, no. 40 years in the desert. He says, I'm ready to go now, I'm ready to go now. And some of them break away, try to go into Israel on their own. What happens to them?
They get killed and driven back.
Yeah, they get wiped out by Amalek and others. And there's an intriguing and profound lesson there in how tshuva is accomplished and how long tshuva can take and what sincere penitence looks like. Because on the face of it, it sounds like they've turned around. They said, now we're ready. A moment ago, we said, we're never going to go. We're never going to win. They now commit to go, and God says, no, it's not good enough. So that's worth probing on its own. We then have, that was Revi, we have Chamishi and Shishi, which are an odd interlude of sacrificial details. We have laws about the Mincha, we have laws about Chala. There's much to say about those on their own and also why they appear here. And then we have another episode in Shavi, an odd episode where there is a Mekoshesh Eitzim, a stick gatherer who is found breaking Shabbos. And that word found is very odd. It says, Vayu b'nei Yisrael b'midbar, and the children of Israel were in the desert, v'yimtzu, and they found a man gathering sticks. And there are two questions on that verse. Number one, where were the Jews? Where were we told they were?
Desert.
In the desert. Now, that's astonishing information. Why?
How do you get sticks in the desert?
Okay, so that's a good question. Where are the sticks coming from in the desert? But had the Pasuk not told me they were in the desert, what would I naturally have thought they would be
in? In the forest.
Why would you think in the forest?
Many sticks there.
Oh, because there are sticks there. That's true. Where have they been for the last 2 years?
In the desert.
In the desert. How many vacation trips did they go on while they were in the desert are we told about?
None.
None. Of course they're in the desert. You're right. When we get to the sticks, I guess that's the question. But the pasuk begins, Vayuba Midbar, and they were in the desert. Astonishing. Whoa, I can't believe it. I thought they were all on a cruise. Of course they're in the desert. They have not moved. They've been in the desert since they left Egypt. Why are we being told right now they were in the desert? And a number of commentaries have different ways of looking at that. I guess one interesting reader might be that it talks about sticks. You may have thought they left, so we're reminding us they haven't moved. But that compounds the reading of a number of commentaries that actually we're being told they're in the desert for two reasons. Number one, They're in the desert surrounded by miracles. They're eating mud. And they're protected by pillars of fire and smoke. And yet there's somebody breaking Shabbos. Meaning one can understand in the winds of assimilation and the threats of modern life that peels away at traditional faith that people struggle to observe tradition. But in an age when you're surrounded by miracle, by a literal celestial mist, they're breaking Shabbos, it's astonishing. And on the one hand, it raises the stakes as to this sinner, but I think it also can lead to compassion on our part. That even surrounded by God, people can make mistakes. And even surrounded by God, faith can be hard. Faith is not always about, do I believe or don't I believe? In a situation when you're in a divine mist, that's not the question, whether you believe in God or not, but it's about your relationship with God. And one can understand or have sympathy that even surrounded by God, relationships can be bumpy. And one has to cultivate a good relationship, even if one is surrounded by evident presence. So that's one reading of them being in the Midbar at that point. The other focus, I can't remember which medieval commentator says this, suggests we're told they're Bamidbar just to stress that they haven't moved. It's so early on, meaning how long have they been keeping Shabbos for? A year? And they're already breaking it. And the Netziv actually presses down on that by saying, V'yimtzu, and they found him. And this could go either way. But what does the term, and they found, indicate that those who found him were doing?
Okay.
They were looking for him.
Excellent. So that's the way the Netziv reads it. I guess you could say they just bumped into him. But he suggests that it could have said, Vayu bin Midbar, they were in the desert, the year, oh, and they saw Mekosha Shetzim, Vim Se'u, makes it sound like they were looking for him. They were looking for someone who was breaking Shabbos. Why on earth were they looking for this guy? So if we were sages sitting around a proverbial fire in the Bet Midrash talking through this parasha, we could all write a midrash on why they were looking for him, what's the backstory. The Netziv says quite simply, they weren't looking for him in particular. They were looking for Sabbath breakers. And he suggests there was some sort of Shabbat police in the Midbar, which kind of grates in some ways and makes us think of intolerance and cruelty. And we think about a theocratic state. They were in a theocratic state, not state in the sense of a nation, but in an existence that was theocratic. God was in charge. And it's odd to imagine that there were enforcers traipsing the camp, but that's the way the Netziv reads it, that they had these figures who were patrolling, which again makes the point that even then, faith is not simple. Observance is not simple. We could do more on that. We'll leave that for now. We have the Mekoshesh Eitzim, and then we have an ending of the parsha with a famous passage that many of us say many times a day. The third paragraph of Shema talking about tzitzit and the importance of that mitzvah. Now, that's our overview of the parsha. I guess it wasn't as brief as I thought it was going to be. I'm going to share my screen with you as we turn to the opening scene of this week's parsha, and we will take a deep dive into the Malbim. So this is Parashat Shlach.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I have a question in that when you think of the other names that have been changed, Avraham went from Avram to Avraham with a hey. Sarah went from Sarai with a hey. Here you have a yud that was added to Yehoshua's name. And it seems to me that it's almost as if Hashem is putting himself beside, within, watching over, because if now it's yud kei at the beginning of Yehoshua's name instead of what it had been. Does this have any significance?
Everything has significance. So yes, yes, it's a very interesting thought. In fact, a couple of the commentaries link up a couple of the exchanges that you mentioned. When Avraham's name is changed, what did you say it goes from?
Avram.
Avram to Avraham. So what happens to his name?
Gets a hey.
Gets a hey.
A hey is added. Sarah's name was changed from...
A yud is eliminated and a hey is added.
The Yud is taken.
So that's exactly the point. The Yud is eliminated. With Avraham, he just gets an extra letter, but Sarai, a Yud is dropped. So what happens to that Yud? And in the same way that Newton believed there was a conservation of mass, there are exegetes or commentators that believe there is a conservation of biblical letters. And that Yud is floating there, having been dejected, and is now absorbed into Yeshua's name. And there is a fundamental bridge or link made between those two figures. And there's a preservation of letters in that sense. But yeah, it's an interesting question. We can probe Yehoshua's change more. And I only share the Torah to me, but there are many other views as to why Moshe changed his name, why he changed it in the way that he did. But it's a fascinating question. Now let's turn to the beginning of the parasha. What I'm going to do, I'm going to read the first few psukim. We'll absorb what they say to the extent that we can, reading them relatively superficially. I'm then going to splurge on your screen the questions with which the Malbim begins his commentary on the parasha. And the Malbim was, in fact, I mentioned this very briefly in passing a few weeks back when we touched on some of the Malbim's biography. He was seen as incredibly conservative, lowercase c, by a number of the Maskilim, the Enlightenment Jewish folk. But he was also seen as quite liberal by some of the Hasidic right-leaning groups. And one of the things that they thought was relatively liberal about him was that he asked questions in his commentary. He began his commentary on a number of prakim with a bunch of questions. What's wrong with asking questions? Nothing particularly wrong with asking questions, but if you ask questions without giving answers first, you give an opening for people to critique and wonder and think, oh, that is a good point. I don't have a good answer. And then you don't read the end, and then you're left with the critique without the resolution. The Malbim is picking up on a method the Yabar Benel had and many others. But he's going to list a number of questions, and then his commentary is going to try to resolve them all in one fell swoop. So let's read the psukim, and then we'll run through. And we will, if all goes well, we'll manage to bring in the Duke of Edinburgh, and Rabbi Sachs and Captain America by the time we get to the end of this. So let's see how we can get them all in. Shlach lecha anashim, God says to Moshe, send for yourselves anashim. What does anashim mean?
Men of distinction.
Oh, interesting. Men of distinction. I didn't see. Was that Dr. Weinstein?
No, it was me, Chip.
Oh, that's Chip. Hi, Chip. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't see your face. I heard a voice. You have a similar timbre, the two of you. Thank you. So, Shlach Lecha Anashim, send for yourselves men of distinction. Now, Anashim can mean men of distinction. Enosh, interestingly enough, has a different meaning on its own. What does Enosh mean? Enosh usually means frail beings.
It's mankind.
So Adam and Ish and Enosh in the singular can mean humanity in different ways, but Enosh is usually Ma Enosh. When in Tehillim we say, what is man? Enosh is seen as frail, but you're right, in this context and in others, and Hashim can mean a men of distinction. V'yaturu et Eretz Kanan, and what will they do? They will scout out the land. Asher anin noten livnei Yisrael, which I will give to the children of Israel, ish echad, one man for each tribe, l'matev otav tishnachu, you will send, kol nasi vahem, all princes, ela shemad ha'nashim ha'shalach mashal ha'torah davis, and then we have the list of all the names. I spared you that text, but then we have a list of all 12 names of all the princes who go to represent the people. Yishlach otam Moshe, Latoritz Canaan. Moshe sent them to scout out the land of Yomalehem, and he said the following to them, Aluze Banegev, go up in the south, for Alitema Tahar, and go up this mountain right on the south. Now, Uriitema Taharetz, and see the land. And these are the mission instructions. I'm sure I would have got this involved as well if I could, but mission impossible. You put on the glasses, and you're told you've got 5 seconds till they self-destruct, but this is the mission should you choose to accept it, and it's usually as brief as possible. And here Moshe appears to wax philosophical as he's giving direct instructions to a group of scouts. See the land, Mahi, What is it like? Ve'ta'am ha'yoshev aleha ha'chazak hu rapeh ha'matu rav. Go see the people here, if they're strong or weak, if they're many or small. Maha aretz, and what the land is, ha'shel yoshev ba, which they live in, ha'tovahi imra'a, whether it's good or bad, u'maharim ha'shel yoshev ba'ena, and the cities that there are there, ha'mavchanim ha'mibzarim, whether they are open fields or whether they are fortresses, u'maha aretz ha'shmenahi imra'za, and to see if the land is fat, or thin, hayeshpa, eitz in mind, whether you've got trees or not, v'itzchatim, l'chatim, priya aretz, and try and grab some fruit while you're there. So if you're one of these 12 spies, or any of these 12 spies, and you've been given these instructions, paraphrase for me what Moshe's instruction is. In as small a space as possible, what would you paraphrase his instruction to be?
Check it out.
Yeah, basically. Go look at the land. Is it good or not? Hatovahi imra'a is all I really need. This little statement here, hatovahi imra'a. But I've got hechazak hu'arape. Is it strong? Is it weak? Are there many? Are there small? Is it good? Is it bad? Are they in fortresses? Are they in fields? Is it fat? Is it thin? Are there trees? Are there not? Oh, by the way, grab some fruit. I am just desperate for some grapes while you're there. So it's a very heavy, excessive statement, textually speaking. But that's the instruction. Now we're going to turn to the questions. I nearly got the Riddler from Batman involved as well when I put these graphics in, but I decided to spare you that. So here are the questions the Malbim poses. And there are six. We don't have to read them all together, but these are some of the questions. So number one, before we get anywhere near this text, why is Moshe sending scouts? What is the aim of this mission? What is the aim of this mission? Because what happens in Dvarim, not in Dvarim, sorry, when Moshe speaks to the people earlier, he says, you will cross the Jordan. You will inherit the land from peoples and tribes that are greater and stronger than you. Moshe has prophetically predicted and pledged and promised to them that they are going to win the war. They are going to inherit the land. And there are tribes that are bigger than you, and there are peoples that are stronger than you, but they will not be an obstacle to you. You will win. Okay, you've given that promise, so what do we need to go scouts for? Question one. Question two. The Mishneh Torah. What's the Mishneh Torah? Excellent. It is a compendium of law written by the Rambam, but that's not what we're referring to here. It is also a code or a nickname. Exactly. It's a code for the book of Dvarim. It appears as a phrase in the book of Dvarim, which is where the Rambam picks his name from. Now, the Mishneh Torah, and in the book of Dvarim, Be'eshi Yisrael Amru, Moshe explains in his retrospective speech in Dvarim, he says, Nishlachan Hashim Lefaneinu. What did the Jewish people say to him? Yisrael Amru, they said, send people for us, the Yachbru Lanu et Haaretz, so that they can spy out the land, the Yashibu Otanu Davar et Haderach Hashem Eleba, they can tell us the way in. Meaning, when Moshe describes retrospectively what happened, he says, the people said, please send spies so we can investigate the land to see how to get in, strategically, how to conquer this land. Ve'im Kain, and if that's the case, Lama Nechnesu El Tocha Haaretz, what are they doing in Hebron? Why do these spies go all the way into the land? They're looking for the way in. They're looking for the best border crossing. What are they doing all the way in? They only have to go up to the border. The best place to conquer and get a foothold. So what Malbim is already beginning with a couple of meta questions. Number one, why are they being spent? There's already a promise they're going to get the land, number one. Number two, if this is really about scouting up borders, like it sounds like Moshe explains it was, why are they going into Hebron and getting a shawarma and getting grapes? They should just be looking at the borders and going back. Number three, and this is an interesting question. You're setting up a spy ring and you want to set in a couple of scouts to figure out how to conquer this land. Which kind of people are you going to pick to go?
Military scouts.
Military scouts. And what kind of people are you not going to pick to go?
Guys in flowing robes who lead tribes.
Excellent. Yes, you're not going to pick the elite people who have never walked a day in their lives, of course, they were all slaves in Egypt, but we're talking about the princes of the tribes. They've been given luxury and elevated over their group and their kinsmen over the last 2 years. And you're taking the princes who you've just listed their names. Some of them are elderly. You're sending them to go and see the best place to conquer. It just isn't adding up here. And not only are these not the best equipped people to go, but they've got a name for themselves. And if they start wandering around, people are going to notice, you know, if England was doing reconnaissance on one of the colonies and they wanted to see what was happening and if they needed to quell unrest, who are they not going to send into the middle of this colony?
Redcoats.
Aristocracy.
Well, they won't send redcoats, and they're not going to send the queen, right? They're not going to say, hey, Queenie, very quietly, just have a little walk around and see what's going on. She will attract attention. If you send the 12 princes who have an entourage and have a name and have, as Mark said, flowing robes, what are you doing? Hello, Tov Yoter, would it not be better? Shielchu Konan Hashim Levad. You don't send 12 people as a group to go together. You send a small number of people. They go their separate ways. Shelo yargishu vam yoshvearetz. So they're undetected. Number four. Bekan, over here it sounds like mashmasha shem tziva b'shlichut ha-meraglim. It says shlach lecha. It sounds like God ordered this. We have no backstory. We finished balotcha with the gossip of Miriam and Aaron and her leprosy and then her healing. And then we shift right. Shlach lecha. God said send. In the Mishnah Torah, in Dvarim, it sounds like that the people asked first and then God permitted it. So which one was it? Number five, we don't have time to do it all. Why does Moshe tell them to go up the mountain? The mountain, if you're looking to wage war on a country and take it by force, where do you tend to think topographically is the worst place to start?
The valley.
Yeah, when they're on top of a hill, you try to begin with the height advantage. And Moshe says, if you want to, we need to go and find the best way in, go climb up that big mountain. It's a very odd instruction. Number five and number six, Moshe's instruction to say, see if it's thin or fat or good or bad or trees or not or cities or towns. What is that all about? So those are his questions. And he answers it in one fell swoop. And this is his answer. For those of you who've seen The Crown, you may recognize that's the Duke of Edinburgh on his tour of what was then waning empire, now the Commonwealth. And the Malbim says essentially, we're not going to have a huge amount of time to go through this. He essentially says there are two kinds of missions that you can send as a nation. One is what we would call traditionally the spy. And that is resembled or symbolized, I should say, on the left side of your screen. Spies are meant to be anonymous, undetected. They're meant to blend in. You don't want famous names. You want them to understand the language, to kind of seep in and come back with information, having not interfered in any way. That's one kind of mission. There's another kind of mission, which is not a spy, but an
diplomatic.
A diplomat, or maybe it's a diplomatic in character, but I guess you would say that it's an emissary or a tourist, right? What is a tourist looking to do? A tourist is looking to see the place, to meet the locals, to get a sense of the culture. And they want to have conversation. They want people to know, I'm a tourist. Please tell me about your culture, not just a blended. And of course, that is represented on the right side of your screen here, where the Duke of Edinburgh went on a 5-month tour of the Commonwealth, went from country to country, meeting the locals, seeing the topography, seeing the officials, meeting the children, going to schools, going to hospitals, playing the local sports, trying to teach them to play cricket, and then taking a lot of pride in winning, having just taught them 5 minutes before. And you can watch The Crown if you want to see how that trip doesn't go so well for him in the long run. But either way, we'll leave that for another time. But those are two different kinds of trips. And the Malbim puts it in these words. And we're not going to read that entire column of text. But he says, Yesh shnei minei meraglim. There are two kinds of spies. Number one, ha'am ha'mavakshim lehem makom l'shevet. If people are looking to start a town, let's say we're all living in New York. We are. We've got all living in New York, unless we have some guests on from elsewhere. And we say, you know what? Property prices are too high. City taxes are too high. why don't we all just look for somewhere in the middle of Nevada where there's just acres and acres of desert. We'll buy acres of land for $10. We'll start up a Jewish community. We'll buy houses for $5. Why not move there? So are we going to tell someone to put on a hat and a beret and a scarf and kind of hide in the desert of Nevada? No, we'll say, go and speak to the tourist board in Nevada. Get a sense of what's happening. Speak to the local authorities about costings and see what it's like there. So this is number one. If you're looking for a place to live, shalchim tchila torim. That's why our whole parsha never mentions the word meraglim. It just says latur, which we could translate as to tour. Send 12 people to tour the land. Hatovaihi imra'ah, to see if it's any good. Bet, what is the other kind of spy? Achar sheshavu hatorim, once those initial scouts, let's say, or tourists come back, hodiyu lehem shemoshvei aretz tov lifneihem, and then they say, yeah, this is good. V'hiskimu l'reshet etale kivsha, and they agree, we're going to go on this mission, we're going to take this land. Then sholchim meraglim, then you send the spies, lirad et ervat ta'aretz. What is ervat ta'aretz? Literally,
it's the nakedness of the land, but you're really talking about the vulnerabilities, probably.
Excellent. Yeah, that is translated in the art scroll as the nakedness of land. Erva means nakedness, and that's exactly what it's taking to mean, as the vulnerabilities. And that's to go back to a group of spies, or at least alleged spies. Yosef accuses his brothers of being spies, coming lirot et ervat ha'aretz, to see the vulnerabilities of the land. And I should say, if you want to see Malbim at his best, let's say, over here may be one destination, but that scene with the brothers being accused by Yosef of being spies, it's a very odd biblical passage, a lot of repetition. It looks like they're talking over each other's heads a lot of the time. And Malbim essentially introduces this distinction and says the brothers thought they were being accused of being military spies, and Yosef was accusing them of being this other kind of spy. It's worth looking at on its own terms. Either way, so the mom says there are two kinds of spies, and these two different spies, not only do they have different missions, the whole dynamic is different. If you're sending these scouts to go and see, is it good? Should we go live there? You can pick big names. You want to pick big names. Why do you want to pick big names? Because you want the people to trust the report. And if people are going to trust the report, they want their representative. They want their leader. They don't want an unknown spy they've never heard of. They don't know where they're from, who they are, what their allegiances are. So number one, you want big names. Number two, if you want these scouts to go, you have a big public send-off. You want everyone to know that it's happening. They're going to hear the report. If you're sending military scouts to uncover military secrets of an enemy, how do you send them?
Secretly.
Secretly, quietly, in the middle of the night. And how does the report come back? Secretly, quietly, in the middle of the night. These are military sensitive subjects, and that's precisely what Yehoshua does at the beginning of Yehoshua in Perek 2. Perek Bet, he sends spies out. He doesn't send 12. He doesn't have representatives of each tribe. We don't really get their names. He sends two people quietly in the middle of the night. Nobody else knows about it because they're on a reconnaissance military mission. This is not what's happening in Parashat Shlach. And that's the way the Malbim reads through the differences. And that's how he's going to answer a lot of those questions. Why they're sending 12? Why they're going up a mountain? Why they're going all the way into the land? Why are they going as a group? Why is Moshe sending them in front of everybody? Why does Hashem agree? But later in Dvarim, when Moshe's talking about it, it sounds like this was not a good idea. And it's because fundamentally there were two things going on. And these spies on their journey got confused, and that's how they failed. They went as Torim, and they came back as Meraglim. Their job, Rabbi Sachs summarizes it, and he quotes some of them. He summarizes it nicely in his covenant conversation this week, where he says, their job was to look for the good, and they came back having had look for the bad. Tourists are meant to come along and say, well, look, these are the advantages of going. And then you send the military scouts to say, look, it's going to be pretty difficult. There's a challenge over here, challenge over there. This is how you should attack. And they fundamentally confused their mission. By the time they got to the grapes, they had a fundamental shift in their mind. That's the way he reads that. Now, we've only got three more minutes. We don't have a lot of time. I mentioned we get Rabbi Sachs and Captain America involved. I don't know how many of you have seen Captain America. Captain America is a mythic, fictional American hero who fought on behalf of the Allies during the Second World War, having been through a scientific experiment that made him super strong and superhuman in many ways. Either way, despite his superhuman strength, he has this locket with him with a picture of a young lady from back home that inspires him through the war. I obviously can't speak from experience. I can only speak from my experience with movies and books. But this is a trope that I think is familiar to many of us, that when people go to war, they hold on to a letter or a picture, a talisman, something that inspires them to remind them what they're fighting for, what they're going to get home for. And Rabbi Sacks has a piece on this week's parasha that suggests that the job of the spies, or the scouts better, the Turim, the tourists this week, was to give the Jews a picture that they could fight for. They knew they were going to win. They were told they were going to win, but they had to have the strength, the conviction to go forward with that fight. And the job of the scouts, of the Turim, was to come back and to tell them, it is unbelievable. There are palm trees, there are hills, there are sandy beaches, there are fertile plains, to give them this image of their future. And what did they came back and they gave them all the horrible things, which undercut the entire purpose. So that's just Rabbi Sacks using the Malbim in its covenant conversation. We have 1 minute left, so we're not going to have time to run through how the Malbim understands the reading of Moshe's instruction, where he says, look for whether it is strong or weak and fat and thin and good or bad, which are all distinct, different instructions Moshe is giving them. I guess we can summarize very quickly that these were three distinct instructions to look at whether the land had an atmosphere, a climate that was accommodating for people. They had to come back and describe the climate, number one. Number two, they had to come back and describe the natural resources. And number three, come back, describe the land's fertility, whether they would be able to have produce. And that's the way the Malbim reads the scene. I was going to finish with one more point here, but we're not going to have time, and I guess we can leave that for next year or another week or another time. Maybe I'll use some of it tomorrow, but I'll wish you all a Shabbat Shalom. I will not eat into the health updates time, so I will stop the